by Christmas to the Chief Minister, beginning with number 264, the Honourable Mr. Fayyad.
Question number 264, the Honourable S.M. Fayyad.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say when the works at Conwy so far are expected to be completed and the estimated cost to these works?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
The Speaker, the current works at Conwy Place are programmed for completion in June 2015. The total estimated cost of these works has not yet been finalised, and therefore, final costs will be available in the course of the next financial year.
Excuse me, could I ask any taking into account of the Chief Minister said, but does it then have a kind of order of cost as opposed to a definitive amount of what the cost would be?
Because we've had these debates in the past, and I've indicated that it's not in the taxpayer's interest that we give an order of cost, because, for example, in the case of this project in particular, because we're obviously involved with it as the Deputy Chief Minister, as we are living on the site, although I've had to move out for a few days because of the work, there are subcontractors still being engaged in negotiations ongoing with some subcontractors in respect of some work, and therefore we don't want to give any indication of what the approved costs are so that we can continue to drive a hard bargain with the contractors. But of course, the total final cost will be disclosed during the course of the budget debate.
May I ask the Chief Minister, at least he can give us some further information to this extent, that he's already gone on record of saying that this particular project is going to cost around £4.5 million, and that's the original estimate he's quoted as having said in the press. Does he envisage that it will come in at less than that, around that, or more than that? I mean, at least perhaps he could provide you with some further information.
Mr. Speaker, I'm very happy to report that the cost estimated at £4.5 million at the time that the project is envisaged are likely to come in on target. In other words, what was going to cost £4.5 million is going to cost £4.5 million, but Conwy Place is a very old building, Mr. Speaker, and therefore, as work move on, new issues arise, and a refurbishment or aspects of the refurbishment are leading to new work which are being required. It may be of interest to the House to know, for example, that the floorboards in some parts of the premises complex are riddled with termites, and therefore there will have to be work done in respect of that work which has now been uncovered and which will require replacement, because of course there are earlier refurbishments didn't deal with that. I mean, they dealt with chandeliers and curtains, but they didn't deal with the infrastructure of the building, which is what is now being uncovered. And therefore, it may be that there will be additional costs, but not because the £4.5 million is not going as far as the £4.5 million should have gone.
Question number 265, the Honourable D.A. Peterson. Mr. Speaker, can the government please state what money has been paid, either directly or indirectly, by the government, a government-owned company, a forestry agency, in respect of the proposed Europa Point Stadium and/or Europa Stadium Limited? Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, a sum of £104 has been charged to Europa Stadium Limited today.
Mr. Speaker, the answer is that I get it absolutely clear, as absolutely no doubt moving to the future, is that taxpayers' money, the extent of the expenditure by the government today in relation to Europa Point and in relation to this particular company is just the figure the only division that is provided to this House now.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, following exactly the words that he has used, the cost of the taxpayer is exactly the figure I have given.
Question number 266, the Honourable D.A. Peterson. Yes. Can the government confirm that the Istanbul Sultan Hotel is registered in a ship or a hotel in Gibraltar, and if not, where is it registered?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Speaker, we'll answer this question together with questions 267 to 272.
Question number 267, the Honourable DAP.
Mr. Speaker, what has been the total indirect or direct cost to government of any entity for which it is accountable of the Istanbul floating hotel, including but not limited to any cost of dredging or passage to allow the hotel to be berthed at its current site?
Question number 268, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Mr. Speaker, has the Istanbul floating hotel been awarded a certificate of fitness by any authority in Gibraltar, and please provide details of the same?
Question number 269, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Can the government confirm that it is not contractually responsible for any maintenance costs in respect of the Istanbul floating hotel?
Question number 270, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
What payments have been made to the government of Gibraltar Credit Finance Company Limited in respect of loans provided by the latter to the owners of the Istanbul or any other entity associated with it?
Question number 271, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Can the government confirm that no further loans have been provided to the owners of the Istanbul floating hotel or any entity associated with it in respect of that hotel since June 2013?
Question number 272, the Honourable D.A. Beaton.
Can the government confirm the owners of the Istanbul floating hotel or any other entity associated with that hotel have paid Credit Finance Company Limited all payments due in respect of loans provided in respect of that hotel on their due date without the need to reschedule, renegotiate, or otherwise postpone the original date of payment?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as previously stated in my answer to questions 210 to 223, and 428 in 2014 and another instance, I believe, the Istanbul Hotel is a private facility, and it is the responsibility of the owners and operators to ensure it complies with any requisite regulations and laws, and the government has no involvement in this. Furthermore, there is no maintenance agreement between the government and the Istanbul Floating Hotel. The Istanbul Floating Hotel is not a building subject to building control, so it is not captured by building regulations, and the government's building control department are not called upon to determine whether a certificate of fitness should be awarded or not. The government, nonetheless, understands that the Istanbul is registered as a vessel in Finland. Government will not bear any cost associated with the Istanbul project. For the benefits of those works have accrued to Ocean Village and Istanbul, the cost will be shared by those who have taken the benefit of said works. Government is in the process of agreeing with both Ocean Village and Istanbul what proportion of the works each is liable for and how they will reimburse the government. Mr. Speaker, as I have said repeatedly in answer to questions of this nature, the loan of monies to the Sunborn by Credit Finance Company Limited is not a matter in which the government will comment, as it is commercially confidential.
Starting with the question of the certificate of fitness, Mr. Speaker, does the government feel comfortable with a situation where the Istanbul floating hotel does not have a certificate of fitness here in Gibraltar? My understanding of the position is that any hotel in Gibraltar would need to have a certificate of fitness. And presumably, the reason why this particular hotel doesn't have a certificate of fitness is because it falls between two stools. In other words, it falls between regulations pertaining to hotels and regulations pertaining to ships. But one way or the other, I would have thought that it would have been advisable for this particular hotel to also have a certificate of fitness, as indeed all other hotels in Gibraltar.
Speaker, before I answer, can I invite the Honourable Gentleman to declare his interest in respect to this question?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sitting at the owner of the hotel, so I'm not sure what interest he wants me to declare. I mean, perhaps he would care to clarify the situation.
Mr. Speaker, why don't the government just partner in the law firm that advises the Sunborn Frozen Hotel? As I understand it, given previous rulings, it is incumbent upon them to declare this interest in that respect. We were required to do so during the course of the budget debate 2011, and during that session, in fact, not in relation to the appropriation bill, simply because Mr. McKinney and I were going to vote on the matter in respect of which a tribe of Assam had an interest. We were going to speak, we were going to vote on the matter in respect of which a tribe of Assam had an interest. So I invite him to declare his interest here as a partner of the law firm that advises the Sunborn Floating Hotel, in respect of which we have now asked some questions to the government as to what might or might not be advised.
He appears to know more about the business of Assam than I do. I have to say, that's the reality. He appears to know more about the business of Assam than I do. I certainly wasn't aware that the Sunborn Floating Hotel, that Assam had been advising the Sunborn Hotel in relation to these particular issues. If that is what he is suggesting, but look, to the extent I must accept the Honourable Gentleman's word for it that Assam is somehow involved with the Sunborn Floating Hotel, to the extent that that is so, Mr. Speaker, I have actually no problem in declaring that is so, accepting his word for it, that Hassan are acting on behalf of the Sunborn Floating Hotel, because of course he appears to know more about the business of Hassan than I do.
Well, Mr. Speaker, if I know more about the business of Hassan than he does, it's that lawyers from Hassan come to see me about the Sunborn Floating Hotel. And they appear to have advised that the Sunborn does not need to apply for a certificate of fitness. It may be, if given everything he said, that he takes issue with the views expressed by some of his partners in the associates working in the firm.
Well, Mr. Speaker, look, I don't take issue with advice provided by any lawyer. I am asking the government questions because they are accountable at the end of the day to this house and to the people of Gibraltar. And I am the leader of the opposition. I also happen to be a partner in Hassan. But look, the fact that somebody from within Hassan, which is a massive organization, has been advising that the Sunday is neither here nor there, I am asking the Honourable the Chief Minister whether he, as a government, as head of a government, feels comfortable with a situation where you have a hotel that does not appear to have a certificate of fitness. That is all I'm asking. Now, surely, that is capable of a very simple answer.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the fact that it sounds a very massive organization wasn't relevant when Mr. Moody and I were simply going to vote on a bill which we weren't even speaking on, and he and the then leader of the House were sitting on this side of the House and insisted that we had to declare an interest simply to say aye or nay in respect of a bill. So it appears that this is the embodiment of the hypocrisy that the Honourable Members of the House displayed as to how they acted when they were on this side of the House and how they act when they are on that side of the House. Something which is manifesting just about every single thing that they do. For example, Mr. Speaker, when they are on this side of the House, they agree to pay to increase their electricity charges by 5% a year, and when they are on that side of the House, they say they have no intention of passing that on to the people who consume electricity. Well, never mind. Mr. Speaker, if none of the government feels comfortable or uncomfortable in respect to certificate of fitness, typically, if the government is advised that the hotel does not require a certificate of fitness, and obviously, the law firm that he is a partner of feels exactly the same way, otherwise, they would have applied for one.
Mr. Speaker, I don't care what advice, I'm not hearing my capacity as a lawyer, what advice has been provided by the time. Nor was I aware that Hassan had advised the government in relation to this particular issue or advised anybody else about this particular issue. But I ask the question because clearly there must be a lacuna in the law. Because if you have a situation where a floating hotel doesn't require a certificate of fitness, presumably because it's classified as some kind of as a ship and therefore doesn't come within the regulations appertaining to a hotel, but then also doesn't come within the regulations appertaining to the registration of ships or yachts in Gibraltar because it isn't quite that, there must be a lacuna within the law in relation to this. And then I was going to ask the Chief Minister, before he got on his high horse in relation to this, whether the government intends to perhaps change the law in order to deal with that lacuna. And perhaps you might care to answer that question.
I've got to be known for my equestrian skills. There's a champion jockey sitting on this side, but it's not really good in that piece, so I don't do high horses. What I will say, Mr. Speaker, is that if the government felt that there was a lacuna in the law, Mr. Speaker, the honourable member says he's not here as a lawyer, but he uses legal terms, a lacuna means a gap. If I thought there was a gap in the law, the government would have filled it. But we are perfectly happy, Mr. Speaker, that his clients are operating legally in Gibraltar.
Mr. Speaker, just out for the benefit of viewers and those that are that don't quite understand the intricacies of this, can you confirm that there is a reason why this ship, this hotel ship, is registered in Finland is because under current laws it can't be registered in Gibraltar because it's not doesn't quite fit under the definition of the relevant definition for the purposes of ship registration in Gibraltar.
No, Mr. Speaker, because I don't know why his clients have chosen to register in Finland and not in Gibraltar.
Mr. Speaker, let's move on with another supplement. Mr. Speaker, I've asked about credit finance, and I asked a question which is an important question, and it's an important question for the purposes of allowing the opposition to properly examine the government, the government, because the government guarantees the money exposure in relation to the loan provided to the owners of the funding. And I've asked whether the government has had to, or credit finance has had to reschedule that debt since the time that it entered into those loans with the owners of the funding. Because of course, if the government has had to reschedule that debt because the owners of the Sanborn have not paid on their due date because they haven't been able to, that obviously raises other questions and it would lead us into a tale of inquiry, which is quite legitimate, Mr. Speaker, in our role as an opposition, in holding the government to account and in making sure that the government does not overexpose the community.
I've made clear the position of the government in a number of things before he knows, and he's asking the question then exactly the answer that's been addressed, which is that we will not disclose the details of the loan book of Credit Finance Company Limited, other than to disclose the full extent of the loan. We can also say how much money has been loaned, but not in detail what has been loaned to whom to them. But, Mr. Speaker, I am prepared to take a completely different line in respect of this loan to the Sanborn. If he confirms to me that his client, Sanborn Limited, have authorized that I give that information across the floor of the House, if he has instructions from Sanborn Company Limited to authorize the government to disclose that information about the details of what they've paid and what they haven't paid, if he wants to check with his client that he has those instructions so I can disclose that confidential information in this house, then I'm happy to do so. But he needs to make clear to me whether he has those instructions from his client.
Mr. Peter, can I make it absolutely crystal clear for the Honourable the Chief Minister and indeed anybody else that's listening out there? I couldn't care less. Not one jot do I care about the views of the Sanborn Floating Hotel. Whether they are clients of my firm or they are not clients of my firm, I am here discharging my duty as leader of the opposition, which I will discharge to the best of my ability. And therefore, if I feel that there is a question of relevance to the taxpayer, of relevance to the people of Gibraltar, I will ask it whether they are clients of Hassan or they are not clients of Hassan. And if the owners of the Sanborn have any complaint whatsoever against me, they can make a complaint to the admissions and disciplinary committee, and no doubt that will be considered in due course. I am perfectly comfortable with the questions that I am asking. But Mr. Speaker, there is a conflict of approach in the way the Chief Minister is approaching this particular question, 272, and the way that he has approached it in the past, which gives rise to a suspicion on my part that the situation has changed. Because in the past, last year, I asked this question and he said that there had been no rescheduling of the debt, that the owners of the sum bond had paid on their due date. Today, he refuses to provide the answer to that question. Why is that?
Especially I've asked him whether he had instructions from his clients about to disclose that confidential information, and he appears not to have those instructions. But if you do that, clearly there are conflicts here. There are conflicts which have just been disclosed to his commercial interest and the position which he's taken here. But there's also conflicts which are speaking in respect of the executive of the GSD. Because I have a letter here from Mr. Rafael Bentadel, which appeared in the Gibraltar Chronicle on Monday the 3rd of November of last year. Now, I don't pay much attention to what that gentleman tends to say, but on this particular occasion, he said something which caught my interest. Talking about whether the Sunborn had received a loan from the government or not, he said, of my statement in this house, true, the government is not providing a loan to the Sunborn out of the consolidated fund, in respect to the things that I said. But the government's own company is from public money. Well, I mean, apart from the fact that this man actually doesn't know what is and is not public money. At least he certainly accepts that what I said in the House was true. So, Mr. Speaker, he's got a conflict of interest between the clients of his firm and what he's advocating in the House. He's got a conflict in his executive as to whether I said in the House in the past about the Sunburn is true or not. His position is riddled with conflict. It isn't about time he got his act together.
Mr. Speaker, the only person that is floundering and fumbling in relation to this issue, as indeed he is fumbling and floundering in the management of the growth of public finances, and indeed who will be found wanting in the management of those public finances, is the Honourable Gentleman and no one else. Mr. Benson, even on the way that he has read that particular letter, it has absolutely nothing to do with the point that I am making. I want to know whether the owners of the Sunborn have paid back the instalment on that loan on their due date. I am not even asking, because I know that he's not going to give me the information, what the size of the loan is. I am asking him, have they paid on their due date? And look, I just simply, and there are going to be people out there listening to the Chief Minister and the evasiveness that is quite patent in the way that he answers the question, who are going to be believing and are going to be saying to themselves, we've got something to hide. Is it because the owners of the Sunburn haven't paid on their due date? I don't know, you may be doing it to the service to the owners of the Sunburn. I don't know. And on that last point, let me say this, so that people outside also understand it. He continues to be a partner in Hassan, and no doubt he knows what happens in Hassan more so than I do.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm just a better light than him on most occasions, so people tend to talk to me more. But let's start from the very beginning, because as Julie Andrews said, that's a very good place to start. He said that I'm fumbling and floundering, and that I will be found wanting. I'm delighted that he said that, Mr. Speaker, because I have yet to hear him make a prediction that comes true. Even if it's about the turnout in the by-election, or the result of the by-election, he's probably one of the few politicians that allows himself to make predictions that he knows are one day going to be judged at the end of a campaign with empirical returns and numbers. He's always got them wrong. So I'm delighted that his prediction is that I'm the one who's going to be found wanting, because by the standards of the past, we know that that prediction is going to end up as an omelette all over his face. As to evasiveness, Mr. Speaker, well, the only person who is evading the issue here is the man who represents the Sunburn floating hotel and is yet trying to make capital in this house of what he appears to think may be a shortcoming in respect of the hotel, whether that is in respect of the certificate of fitness, or whether it's about his client paying their loan liabilities, etc. Mr. Speaker, frankly, I think what he has said about his firm, which also happens to be the firm on which I am in a sabbatical, leaves a lot to be desired. Because nobody in this house has ever said, I represent those people separately, but here I do the opposite of what might be in their interest. Everybody in this house have declared interest in their country, they've been clear about how they represent the people of Gibraltar in a way that doesn't conflict with their commercial interest, and where there might be a conflict, allows another member of the parliament on their side to deal with those issues so that the community is not in any way let down if there were issues to be followed up, but those personal conflicts are not highlighted, and in the way that he has really brought to the forefront of what it is that he does professionally and what he does for. So what do we know about the independent part of government? The government has said what it has said repeatedly about the loans of credit finance. I am very happy, Mr. Speaker, that credit finance is doing an excellent job. The returns that have been produced are absolutely excellent. And, Mr. Speaker, I have absolutely no desire to continue down the road of a debate that the honourable gentleman wants to have, which he may think is very much in his interest today, but he might think sooner than he thinks was not perhaps the right argument to be pursuing for so long, because there may be more than one omelette flying in this direction.
I quite enjoy omelettes, I have to say, I have six every day. Mr. Speaker, the Sunbourne Hotel, because I wouldn't want anybody out there to be misled by what the Chief Minister said, are not my clients. I'm not speaking. I don't know who they are. They may be clients of the firm. And I have to accept the honourable the Chief Minister's word for it, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, may I be allowed to continue?
For over an hour at the last meeting of the House, there were very heated exchanges between the Chief Minister and the leading opposition. And to a certain extent, I was conscious of the fact that I was allowing them perhaps too much leniency. And subsequent to the meeting, I was approached by a number of people. One in particular with very inside knowledge about the proceedings of Parliament as to whether I hadn't been too lenient. And I said, yes, I think I have been too lenient. And I was lenient because I want to lay down a marker. And that marker is that between now and the general election, I am not going to permit exchanges in this House at question time to become a standing line. If honourable members want a standing line, they better put somebody else in this thing. I am not going to play that game. Okay? But I am conscious of the fact that I allow too much leeway, but I am not going to allow it today. Okay? If necessary, I will suspend the speaking of this House so that for half an hour, so that temperature cools. But I am not prepared to go through that again. I don't see why I should. I am at an age when I don't have to, when my blood pressure might dangerously, and I might not be here after the last election if it is that members would want me to be here. So having laid down that marker, let us see whether common sense can prevail, and let's get on with the business of the House, which is what we have all about.
I said we didn't want your health to suffer as a consequence of any questions or any exchanges with the Chief Minister during 2 minutes of question time. Mr. Speaker, all I want to ask the Chief Minister is this, perhaps this can cover the question, if what his objection is, me standing here because my firm appears to be acting according to him for the owners of the Sunbourne, I don't know. What if my honourable gentleman, my friend, Mr. Bassino, were to ask exactly the same question, 272, in terms of whether the owners of the Sunbourne, have paid on their due date, or there's been any rescheduling of that date, would the Chief Minister answer the question in those circumstances?
The figures were put it at the next meeting of the House. But Mr. Speaker, let us be very clear. The Honourable Gentleman has said that he is taking my word for the fact that the Sunbourne is a client of the Sunbourne, as he wasn't aware of that. But Mr. Speaker, I accuse him of misleading the House. I accuse him of misleading the House, and I'm prepared to move a motion for that purpose, because in a
in a chronicle newspaper article of the 4th of July 2013, we had an exchange, and we will not recall it in the past, which is reported in the chronicle, but I made reference to the fact that we stumbled at the time of the time. We followed that up with a press release on the 3rd of July 2013, which was a government press release about the stumbling of the time of the time. And we followed that up again on the 22nd of July 2013 with a government press release that set out that Hassan was the lawyer for the funding. I therefore believe that he has misled the House, unless he tells me that he forgot those exchanges. And if he does, then I will relent from my accusation of misrepresentation.
That he can bring whatever motions he wants to bring. And I will answer and I will meet whatever motion he wants to do. And he wants to see the fact in the manner that he feels, in his own judgment, he has to do. And if he brings a motion, I will deal with it. The issue of actually Hassan's acting on behalf of the Sunday has arisen in relation to the question of the certificate of fitness. I have actually no clue about Hassan acting in respect of the certificate of fitness. And advising the government or anybody else as to whether a certificate of fitness is necessary in this particular case. But look, that is irrelevant. He brings whatever motion he wants to bring, and I will need to head on.
Now, my own microphone was on, which means that the camera has been on me for the last 2 minutes, so I apologize. But having regard to the fact that there are six questions which were answered together by the Chief Minister, does the Leader of the Opposition or any other member of the Opposition have any other supplementary on these questions before we move on? Then I will ask the clerk to call question 273.
Question number 273, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
And Mr. Speaker, how many people have been naturalised British in Gibraltar since December 2011? And how many of those have applied to join the housing waiting list?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
On the 2nd of December 2011, 992 people have been naturalised for the British role. Of these, 192 have applied to join the housing waiting list.
Question number 274, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, does the government intend to end the current discrimination against Gibraltarian men married to foreign women in the issue of residency permits for their partners under the Immigration, Asylum and Refugee Act?
Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, according to the position of the alleged current discrimination is that established by the previous GST administration. The present administration is considering a change to the rules. We expect to be in a position to make an announcement shortly.
If I don't mind talking to the Honourable Gentleman behind the Speaker's chair in relation to this particular issue, but of course, until the government amends the legislation, and I expect this legislation probably actually going back many, many years, the current discrimination against men who are married to foreign ladies is going to set to continue. I believe that I have found a way in which that can be dealt with in a manner that will allow applications to be dealt with by men in a way that is not discriminatory. Because the present position is that if a Gibraltarian woman married to a foreign man, if a foreign man applies for a residency permit, there isn't the limitation in terms of the length of the permit that can be granted when one takes into account the position of men married to women. At the moment, if you're a man married to a foreign woman, the foreign woman, when applying for a residency permit, will get 6 months, at most a year. That difference is obviously discriminatory. I think that I found a way in which, and I don't want to, but I don't propose to deal with this across the floor of this house, I think that I found a way in which it can be dealt with on a matter at a discretion level until the government changes the law, and I wonder whether he is recipient to talking to me about this particular issue. I've also expressed it, I have to say, to the Chief Secretary, I know that the Chief Secretary has spoken to his name in the GP.
Mr. Speaker, I think I know what Faith is talking about. It's a case that has come to me too. I believe I know a way of dealing with this discrimination as well, which will enable us to deal with that case in particular. I believe that that may be ways of dealing with the whole issue very quickly. So this is what I'm looking at, but we have, of course, before we act, to look for advice on whether there are consequences to our actions and what the floodgates might bring, although my instinct is that there will not be any floodgate opening, but the civil service is very good at making those checks and ensuring that when we act, we act properly and in a way that is not going to cause a problem that we might not envisage. I'm quite happy for him to write to me the issues, but I think we have to determine the way in which the water will.
We now move back to question 246, it's a question of the Minister for Education and Justice, and the question that is the Honourable Assembly Ellis.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Justice provide an update to this House of the total running cost of the taxpayer of all matters similar in service arising from the collapse of the local monarchy in 2010?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Speaker, the total running cost of the taxpayer of all matters criminal and civil arising from the collapse of the law firm Marathon Code in 2010 is 7012070.65.
Question number 247, the Honourable SNCR.
Can the Minister for Justice provide up-to-date prison occupancy figures further to answers given to question number 659 of 2014?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, the daily average prison population expressed on a month-to-month basis from November 2014 rounded to the nearest person is November 2014, 49. December 2014, 48. January 2015, 48. February 2015, 55.
Question number 248, the Honourable D.A. Keaton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government please state what is envisaged to be the annual recurrent cost of running the small boat marina when it is completed?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Education and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, I assume that the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition is asking what is envisaged to be the annual recurrent cost to the government of running the small boat marina when it is completed. The answer to that question is zero.
But can you explain why it's going to be zero? If we're talking about effectively what is a government facility built by the government for small boat owners, but my understanding of the project was that the government was going to be providing these berths, but effectively the facility itself continues to belong to the government. Now, a facility like that, at sea, there would be quite a high level of maintenance, I would have expected, in relation to something like that. Unless, of course, the government has intent to subcontract, for example, or provide a contract to a third party for the running of the entire facility. Can you explain?
Mr. Speaker, the explanation is quite simply by analogy to the other small boat marina, which they do, whilst in office, and the annual recurrent running cost to the government of running that other marina, the former Canberra marina, as I understand, it is a zero. That is, even though it is owned by the government, that other marina is run on the basis of a club, and people pay bathing fees, people pay membership fees. And after that bathing and membership fees, the running costs are met. It is envisaged that whatever fees are charged per boat, in respect of the 700 berths that will be available in the small boat marina, that whichever way it is run, whether it's a flower board or some other entity, certainly not going to be run by the government. but whichever way it is run, and we have the example of the other marina, which is right beside it. And the cost of that is zero, in the same way the cost of this is zero.
Yes, the Camber marina is much smaller marina. But so that I can do the calculation in my own time, what are the kind of fees that the government are going to be charging in relation to the club in relation to the berthing facility that will then allow it to make it self running? And also, can I also ask them this, does the government have any figures in terms of what it believes would be the maintenance cost, obviously not to the government, but to whatever entity it is, that the view that the government has made the calculation of, well, we're going to be getting X amount from all these berthing, or the club is going to get X amount from all these berthing fees, and the maintenance a year is going to cost X, so it's going to be within that budget self-generated through the generation of fees.
Peter, the honourable member asked what fees the government will be charging. The government will be charging no fees at all. This will be a matter for whoever's running the marina. The marina is new built. Berths have not yet been allocated. They will be allocated in due course. And at some point, there will be a committee representative who will decide how the club or the marina is going to be run. And I would agree that the honourable member mentions the other marina and says, well, that is much smaller. But precisely that is to the benefit of this particular marina, because there will be double the number of boats and potentially double the amount that will be collected, but presumably not double the amount that will be incurred in cost. Because if you have one person dealing with all the admin, whether it's for 300 or 400 or 500, you get more fees out of 400 or 500, but you still have one person doing the admin. So the economies of scale are such that this particular marina should be, in fact, more efficient in terms of running costs than the other marina, which is smaller. So, no, the government will not be charging anything. The government will simply be engaging with the representatives of those who are allocated there in due course to see how it is supposed to run that marina. But the government doesn't get involved in the running or charging of anything in respect of the former and Camber marina, and that is run by them at no cost to the government. That is exactly the same with happening in this particular marina.
I understood the honourable gentleman the first time, but I would have expected, and if he hasn't, I mean, I'm not going to press the honourable gentleman, but I would have expected that in the government's plan to build this particular marina, and bear in mind that all sorts of things can go wrong, and things do go wrong sometimes. I mean, anyway, even if things don't go wrong, I would have expected the government to have had calculations in terms of how many fees that this marina was going to be generating and how much it would cost for the maintenance to make sure that the fee generation would cover the maintenance. So it doesn't have those figures, and doesn't have those figures, the annual recurrent cost and the fees that you would expect would be generated through the fees for the bank.
Mr. Speaker, it's not a question of the government not having these costs. These figures are irrelevant for present purposes, because the government has taken the view that the cost of running that marina is zero to the government. Now, if the honourable member wants to insist that the government should take money out of its pocket and be paid for that, that's another argument, and that's something that perhaps the honourable member might take up. And he says, things do go wrong. Yes, of course things do go wrong. In the Cormoran Camber Marina, things have gone wrong. In October, was it 2008 or 2007, there was a massive storm, and there was damage, but there was insurance. So if people are running in the marina, they will have insurance for things that go wrong. And that, as I understand it, my recollection is that the damage that occurred, again, resulted in no cost to the government, because you expect whoever's running the marina to have insurance to cover these things. So I reiterate, there is no cost, there will be no cost to the government.
And Mr. Speaker, in relation to this particular small boat marina, it will be taken up by small boats, and there's not going to be any usage at all by the government in any way, shape, or form which will mean that the government will have to make a contribution in relation to the meeting. And can you just confirm that?
The Speaker, it will all be taken up by small votes. There are 6 meter versions and 7 meter votes. We haven't envisaged keeping an allocation of those votes for the government, as that is what the Honourable Member needs. But if there is, for example, a need, and I don't know if there is, I just as a hypothetical example, there was a vote with the Department of the Environment granted. There was another similar situation whereby a government department needed a berth and applied for a berth and was granted a berth, then that department could contribute whatever the burden seems to in the same way as anybody else that was allocated a berth.
Question number 249, the Honourable Dean Davis.
Can the Minister for the Division of Savings Bank please state which locations the bank will be operating from?
I am for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Speaker, the savings bank will be operating from 104 and 260 to 229 Street.
Speaker, it's 104, and then it's 260 and 286. Just for the system, and I'll explain my in a supplementary that's relevant. Is 104 the one just opposite the one that's already open and launched opposite the cathedral? The old Maratha building, or is that 206, 210? And then, you know, which one's the other one?
The opposite, the cathedral is 206, 210. I would hope the Honourable Member works sufficiently enough to make his speech to know where the numbers are. But yeah.
Speaker, I can confess I'm absolutely terrible with these things. And the 104 is then which one? It used to be the Lloyd. The Lloyd Bank building? No? I'm going the other way. I should be going the other way, shouldn't I?
The 104 is the post office in Main Street, which also operates a savings bank. Yes.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. And I think from answers that I've had in this house before, we've been told that the location where the old Lloyd Bank used to be, obviously, as a matter of course, was also going to be an outlet for the Baltic Savings Bank. I see that again, as I mentioned. Can you provide any further information in relation to that specific location?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. The original plan was to use the Main Street Savings Bank location for the post offices to expand the role of the present main office of the savings bank. At a later stage, when the building where Lloyd Bank used to be became available, that was looked at an alternative to the post office location, which was where the expansion was going to take place. And I was informed that the cost of converting the Lloyd Bank building and amending the plans of the post office to adjust them to the other location would be of the order of £250,000, and I gave the go-ahead for that to happen. And then at a later stage, I saw some correspondence which indicated that the £250,000 had become £1.5 million, and in line with the way that I discharged my responsibility, I need to be protected.
So, Mr. Speaker, that then must be the explanation which I've seen with my own eyes as to why there's been absolutely no works in the Lloyd Bank building. But it works to the value, if I understand the answer correctly, works more or less to the value of £1.5 million that have already been undertaken in respect of that particular case.
Is that correct? No, Mr. Speaker, that is not correct, and it would be extremely stupid if I had stopped it after the work had been done. I stopped it before the work was done, obviously. Otherwise, there would have been no saving.
So the actual expenditure was £250,000. Is that the case?
The actual expenditure was, I can tell you that the budget was £250,000, and when I saw the budget ballooning, and this had not been cleared politically, I put a stop to it, and I'm not prepared to take responsibility for expenditure in excess of approved budget unless I have taken on the responsibility for taking the decision. And this is done at the level of the officials who, appear to think that what was worth investing £250,000 is still worth if it costs £1.5 million. So the answer is the work has been stopped because in my judgment there was no justification in terms of the value of the building to us. If that kind of money was being spent on a building that is rented, by the way, yes, rented, other than our own property, and it's much better we're going to spend that kind of money to spend it on a property that is ours, which was what it originally was intended to be. So the building will be put to another use because we're renting it and paying rent, and we'll see, how much money you can save between what was originally budgeted and what was intended to spend.
Mr. Speaker, may I congratulate the Honourable Judge for not allowing himself to be brainwashed by consulting, and may I commend his example to the rest of his parliamentary colleagues. Mr. Speaker, what about the Lloyd's building? Are there any plans for the Lloyd's building? I know that he says it's rented, it's not owned by the government. But are there any plans? Does the government have any plans in relation to that particular building?
So there's a strong possibility that it may finish up as the Ministry for Economic Development.
Question number 250, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lillingham.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Social Services say when the eligibility for quarterly household cost allowance payments for community care will be extended to disabled persons as outlined in the Government Manifesto?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the matter is under discussion with community care.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister say that it is likely to happen before the end of this parliament?
I can say that I would expect it to happen before the end of the parliament, and to the extent that it's in my power to make it happen again.
Question number 251, the Honourable E.J. Haley.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Training provide updated details in respect of all trainees can be enrolled at the Construction Trade Training Centre, listing the specific discipline of course being followed, as well as indicating at what NDC level?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer together with question 252.
Question 252, the Honourable E.J. Haley.
Can the Minister for Training provide updates of details in respect of all trainees can be enrolled at the Engineering Training Centre, listing the specific discipline of course being followed, as well as indicating at what NDC level?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
The updated details are Construction Training Centre, Carpentry 8, Level 1, 2 Level 2, 4 at Level 3. Brick Lane 5 at level 2. Clustering 5 at level 2. Tiling 2 at level 2. Plumbing 5 at level 1. Painting and decorating 5 at level 1. Skip box, fabrication or welding 4 at level 2 and 4 at level 3. Mechanical engineering 5 level 3. Electrical installation 7 level 2. Motor mechanic 7 level 2.
Question number 253, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
What prominent increases have there been in numbers of employees in the public service since the 1st of January 2012, broken down by reference to civil service, the UC, and any other government company, public affairs, or entity for which the government is accountable?
Answer the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Increase in the number of employees since January 2012 has been civil service 277, agencies, authorities, and companies 211.
Question number 200.
I may be missing something here, but my calculation in terms of the increases in the public service was 531, I can't remember, I've got to look at my notes, but it's round about that figure. The Chief Minister and Communiques have denied that that is the accurate figure. Well, the figure that is, the implication is much lower. The figure that the Honourable Gentleman is providing you is close to 500. So we're not too far apart. Am I missing something in the, the figure that he's providing me is 218 is 311. So it's basically 418, exactly, 418. And I would say 511. So it's only a difference of 20. Now, am I missing something here? Because, of course, I mean, to have an argument over 20 doesn't seem to me to be a reasonable point for the government to be making.
Well, bigger. The difference is bigger because, in fact, when he was quoting the 513, he wasn't quoting it up to now. He was quoting it up to the figure of 6 months ago. Obviously, it wouldn't have been 536 months ago, because then would have had to decline quite dramatically in the last 6 months, which is not what has happened. I think we should take note of the fact that 197 of the increase are the dinner ladies who were, at the time that he was in government, employed by a private company and supplied to the government, and who were converted into government employees after the general election. Others are increases that have taken place in the civil service because of the supply teachers that were made permanent teachers. So, in fact, this is not 488 more clerical grades. This is 488 more public servants. I think to put it in context so that it may help him in deciding his duty to see whether the growth is excessive or not, it may help him to know that in the 3 years between December 11 and December 14, the growth has been 8.9%. And in the 3 years preceding, that is the last 3 years when he was there, the growth was 12.9%. So we still got a margin of 4% to catch up with it.
Well, can I examine whether we get to that margin, accepting that this figure is correct, of course? Do these figures actually take into account the 17 customs officers that extra recruitment within the customs service that we know is going to be taking place, or indeed is in the process of taking place at the moment?
And Mr. Speaker, this is a figure as at the end of December last year, and therefore a proportion of those will be counted, but certainly nothing like 70. Maybe it might be 20 have come in so far.
Question number 254, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
And Speaker, can the government explain why some employees of Skills Enhancement Training Company Limited are being paid by DJBM?
I'll answer the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the information implied by the question is not correct.
Mr. Speaker, let me tell him that a couple of people have been to see me just before the question, are concerned that they are being told by the Ministry of Employment, as it happens, that their wages, and they're employed by this particular company, Skills Enhancement Training Company, in order to do short-term courses, I think it's about 6 weeks, 5-6 weeks, in order to be trained in relation to Mount Alvernia and provide services there and elsewhere within the care agency. And they were being told that the company that was to pay their wages, what was owed to them, and these people had not been paid for 2 months. In other words, they finished their course, 2 months later, they still haven't been paid, was DJBS, which seemed extremely odd to me. I mean, I have to say, I saw their employment contracts and I could see that the employment company was Skills Enhancement Training Company. But I could see nothing in relation to DJBS, so that's the information they were being provided. And indeed, when they went to DJBS, they were being told by DJBS that the government hadn't put DJBS in funds to allow them to be paid.
I know that the Honourable Member has not been in politics as well as I have been, but he couldn't believe everything that he said.
First of all, JBS does provide a service to a training company in that they produce the calculations for us, because it's cheaper for us to use their payroll system than to fabricate one of our own and duplicate services which cost more money. But of course, the employer pays the employee, even though they may have outsourced the function of preparing the wages. Secondly, everybody that goes on a 5-week course is told at the beginning of the 5-week course that it will take 10 days after they have finished the course for them to receive their wages. And they don't receive their wages until after the 5 weeks, because otherwise we are not in a position to ensure that the people have done the 5 weeks for which they get paid. Thirdly, nobody has ever had to wait 2 months at the end of the 5 weeks to get paid. And in fact, if they did, there would have been a backlog, because every 5 weeks there's a new cohort of people coming in. So clearly, if everybody had to wait 2 months, there wouldn't have been 2 people, there would have been 48 people without payment, because there are 24 in each input. So the information is wrong on every single count. People do not wait 2 months, they wait 10 days. They get told they wait 10 days before they start. They never get paid before the 10 days. These people have been paid within the 10 days. The people that went to him also came to me. I investigated it, and the 10 days were not yet up. And in any event, it is not, JBS is not the entity responsible. JBS happens to be the entity that has a section of its administration which prepares pay for 500 construction workers, and therefore for a small fee, they do the calculation for a training, which is a cost effective way of doing it. And that's the explanation. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm very grateful for the explanation. Can I tell him that actually the people that came to see me are his own supporters? They are voters, yes, they do. not do as really supported, but of course I just have my duty to relate to everybody, not just people that are going to be voting for the DOD, but of course that's my responsibility. So when I speak to these two individuals tomorrow, if I'm going to be telephoning them, what I will say from the honourable gentleman is communicate from him is that you should have been paid within 10 days. And that if you haven't been paid within 10 days, and it happens not to be the individual that has already been to see the honourable gentleman, to go and knock on the honourable gentleman's door. Because of course if it is true that these people have not been paid after 2 months, and look, I have no reason to doubt the fact that is so, from what they've told me, then of course under the honourable gentleman's explanation, they should have been paid and they will be paid.
That is absolutely correct. If anybody has not been paid for 2 months after finishing the course, is something that should not happen, and I'm assured has not happened. And the fact that there should be GSLP voters that went to him surprises me not in the least, because it's the hallmark of the GSLP members that they always complain.
Question number 255, the Honourable D.A. Stephen.
No doubt they will soon feel at home within the DOD. Mr. Speaker, how many companies were on the approved contractors list as of the 1st of December 2011?
According to the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the number on the list on the 1st of December 2011 is not known. At the close of that month, that is at the end of December 2011, the total was 91.
I think the only way that you can me on the or trava. I'm afraid that I have to put up with the money. Let me get on with the serious politics that I and the father of the house want to be engaged in. The infantile behavior in a program, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, does the honourable father of the house have the figure for the end of November? So that I can see what really was the position when we were in government, because we know what the position is today. That's really what I'm getting at. So do you have the figure of the 30th of November?
No, Mr. Speaker, because as I think I've told him in the past, the alert approved contractor list that was supposed to exist in the technical services department, where there were companies identified for different kinds of work and for different volumes of work in terms of special contracts, was in complete disuse, had not been touched for years, and included a lot of bad companies, and that was not the list that was being used by the employment service. The list that I've given him was the list that was compiled by me in December from the people who were getting work and who were then in existence, even though they were not identified as being approved contractors de facto. They were being given work as approved contractors, and therefore I started off with a list made up of the people who were getting work at the time, and I can certainly give him that a copy of that list. So you must have the 91 that were there in December when we took over. But the list was compiled by me getting information on different entities doing different work in different places, because in fact when the announcement was made in 2010, I think the subsequent evolution of that policy in 2011 happened on an ad hoc basis, on the basis that instead of there being a compiled list from which people were invited to submit a price for work, people submitted a price for work, and I think gave the list subsequently, as it were. But I can tell him that the list that I've got from December is plus the one subsequent to December of the new incorporated company is the one that operates today. So I think almost all the people that were over 91 there are still in existence. I think there may be one or two that have fallen by the wayside, but I think most of them are there. And therefore, this would be the people that were available to do work for the previous government going from December backwards.
I would appreciate if the Honourable Gentleman were to provide me with the list. My recollection, and I have to say that I've looked back at Hansard and I haven't been able to find it, was that on the actual approved list, and I understand what the Honourable Gentleman is saying, that what he's taking, this is not enough, this is not people on the approved list, this is people who are doing work for the government as at December of 2011, 91. On the approved list, as far as I can remember, there were some 45 companies on the approved list. I get that date. That's my recollection, but I haven't been able to find anything in Hampstead to substantiate that. But if you could provide me with a list, that'd be very good.
Question number 256, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
Can the government please provide a list of companies or individuals who have the benefit of a contract with either the government, a government-owned company, government authority or agency for which the government is accountable for installation or maintenance of listed government-owned buildings, including housing estates?
I consider the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, the companies are Singla, General List, Altus, Embarga and Send.
Because these are the names of companies,
the five companies that I've been told are doing work either in installation or maintenance.
And these are the companies that the government is contracting directly with. In other words, what we're not dealing with is a situation whereby, for example, Ortiz is engaged to provide maintenance facilities or installation of lifts by a third party. In other words, the government contracts with a third party, the third party contracts with us. We're talking about direct contracts between these five companies and the government or government agents and entities.
Information of what? There is no intermediary. These are the people that are doing the work and the people who are for the contract. Yes?
Mr. Speaker, does he have a details of the estate in relation to each one of the of these five companies?
In terms of, I mean, the some of the companies have just been contacted to come in and put a list. But I can tell him that in terms of the ongoing maintenance of the estate, Ortiz have got 55 lists, and Barban has got list at Bishop Canilla, and same has got the list at Albert Bishop. So the 55 lists are the lists that are not in either Bishop Canilla or Albert Bishop.
Mr. Just point of clarification. I think he's been talking about five companies, but I've got it down four. The one missing, we've got Simler, Altus, Embarga, and Finn.
Question number 257, the Honourable D.A. Peterson.
I think my honourable friend, Mr. Sigurd, has a supplementary in relation.
Apologies, Mr. Speaker, and just a question. Of the five that were mentioned, four are well known, four are very recognisable. Is General List another non Gibraltar registered list operator?
Okay, my knowledge, the only one that is registered in Gibraltar and employs people in Gibraltar is Generalist. All the others have people in Spain and send them out here to do work.
Is Generalist a company? I've not, obviously not been able to do any company searches in relation to this, and the mission is coming now. But is Generalist a company that's been incorporated relatively recently, over the last 2 or 3 years, and can provide us with information in relation to who are the people behind Generalist? As indeed I asked the Honourable the Minister for Sport to provide some information in relation to that, and he's quite kindly provided it this morning.
I don't think, I know it would appear to me that the Honourable Member is biased against about the company, because he wants to know who is behind a local company, but he's quite happy not to know who is behind Otis and Barbara, Spain, or anybody else that is based in Madrid or Algeciras. And the answer is no. I'm not here to tell him who is behind the company. We do business with a company which is a legal entity. We do it with Spanish companies because we've not had Gibraltar companies. I wish there were more Gibraltar companies because I want the rest of the taxpayer paid for to stay as much as possible in Gibraltar and to provide economic activity in Gibraltar and profit for Gibraltarians and work for Gibraltarians.
Because I didn't need to get upset about the question. I mean, I fully agree with the aim of providing more employment for Gibraltarians and attracting Gibraltar companies and allowing businesses to stay here. But I'm also perfectly entitled to make the observation, which is an observation which is quite clear, that four of these companies are well known. Which company? There's one, which isn't. Now, the information which we have is that this particular company is associated with well-known geographies for purpose. And that's where the question arises. And of course, we're perfectly entitled to examine that. And no doubt, we will come back and we will ask, you know, about these contracts, where they went out to tender, where they didn't go out to tender, etc., etc.
The Honourable Member expects me not to be upset about the fact that he prefers the work to go to Spanish company than to a Gibraltarian who happens to go to the GFID. That doesn't upset me. I can tell the Honourable Member that as far as I'm concerned, I prefer a GFID supporter to get the work than an outsider.
And Mr. Speaker, can you assure the House of this, that we're not dealing with a situation where contracts for the maintenance or installation of lifts go to a particular company, who then just put these subcontracts to one of the other four who are recognized suppliers and installers of lifts. In other words, that what you're not doing is adding another layer to the taxpayer of Gibraltar simply to award a contract to your own supporters.
I will tell the civil servants in the procurement office that the leader of the opposition suspects that they are awarding contracts to create a layer for GSLP members to skim off an additional profit. So certainly I have not been involved in awarding the contract because this is not a political decision. I can tell the Honourable Member that the rules that exist are that if somebody gets a contract, the subcontractor has to be approved by the government, and that in all the contracts that come my way, I make sure that there is a constant supervision of the use of subcontractors to ensure that there are people who are properly registered, that their employees are registered with B2B, that they are up to date with their tax, and that they are up to date with their insurance. And that there is no question of somebody giving off a layer of profit and providing no value in exchange for a profit. So, if the Honourable Member suspects that that is the case here, I will investigate it and satisfy myself that it is not.
But, Mr. Speaker, if I might, I think it is incumbent on the government to clarify that the only instance where we have found evidence of layers being added of cost to the taxpayer are in high-profile, expensive contracts granted without tender by the previous administration to companies owned and operated by supporters of the GSD on the basis of cost plus, namely
contracts granted to followers, contracts granted to King's Bowl, contracts granted to Master Services, contracts granted to GLRC, all of them companies owned and operated by what were then high profile supporters of the government who achieved those contracts without tender, and which contracts were based on the cost being charged to the taxpayer, with an agreed increase on the cost of 10%. In other words, the more the contract costs, the more it costs the taxpayer, with the obnoxious 10% cost plus added. And that is the layer of fat added by a government to the taxpayer's cost to its own supporting company, of which there is only evidence once in the history of the vote, and that is in the 16 years that they were in government.
Well, Mr. Peter, I don't know. I don't know whether any of those companies or the people that he was mentioning were supporting the GSD or.
I have to say, he's very poor.
He's very poor. But he votes for the GSD than I am. And I have to say that. I didn't know that the people associated with colour work were GSD supporters. Well, look,
I didn't.
Are well known local team supporters such as Mr. Cardona and Mr. Alin. Is that the case?
Mr. Speaker, it is the case that the Honourable Gentleman seems not to know any of the things that he ought to know to prevent himself from getting up and appearing to the other red nose in this house. Because he doesn't want to know the things that demonstrate that he and his party are the ones who have been responsible for the greatest level of nepotism and cronyism which Gibraltar has ever seen at a huge cost to the taxpayer. Whether it has been in the award of contracts for the development of the airport, or for the cleaning of Gibraltar, or for the reparation of part of the King's Factory in
Legislature. I don't think that these 15 stories are up in mind, because we are going to move on. Who would have thought that such a simple answer was going to generate so much heat? We go on to the next question. Question 257, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Peter, yes. And Peter, from the teaching of the Free State, what the government cash reserves were as of the 1st of March 2015?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
I will answer the question with questions 257 to 259 and 261.
Question 258, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Peter, can the Chief Minister please give a breakdown by banking amount of that part of the aggregate public debt which comprises bank debt as at the 1st of March 2015?
Question 259, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister provide this task with a breakdown by the debenture issue of that part of the aggregate public debt which comprises government debentures as at the 1st of March 2015?
Question number 260, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Can the Chief Minister please provide details of the value of Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures or other debt security as at the 1st of March 2015?
Question number 261, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
Can the Chief Minister please provide a breakdown of where and how all the money deposited in the Gibraltar Savings Bank have been invested and the rate of return on each of these investments as at the 1st of March 2015?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, I answer in my capacity as Minister for the Gibraltar Savings Bank and Economic Development.
The government cut first for February were £73.48. As at the end of February, the aggregate debt consisting of bank debt was Barclays Bank PLC £150 million and NatWest Castor £50 million. The government debentures by maturity date were as follows: 2017 debentures, £5,993,500. 1 month notice debenture, £241,879,600. The value of the Volta Savings Bank debentures and other debt securities by maturity date for 1 month, £31,658,300. 2015 debentures, £8,990,600. 2016, £22,935,600. 2017, £97,389,600. 2018, £163,777,600. 2019, £154,454,600. Other debentures, £147,614,246. Bonds, £98,054,400. Deposit account, £226,536,300. The average yield of the different categories of investment vehicles by the savings bank for the month of February was as follows: on call accounts of the Bank of England, the Crown Agent, the Gibraltar Bank at an average yield of around 0.55%, the Gibraltar Banks being the Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays Bank, NatWest, Ulster Bank, and Lloyds Bank. Floating rate notes quoted from the London Stock Exchange at an average yield of 0.98%. The floating rate were issued by the following: European Investment Bank, IMEF, International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, Netherlands Bankers Bank, KfW, Republic of Finland, Volkswagen Financial Services, Dexia, GE Capital UK, Westpac Securities, Australia and New Zealand Banking Group, Centrica PLC, ASB Finance Limited, Royal Bank of Canada, DG Energy Capital PLC, Suncom Medway Limited, BMW Finance, National Grid Gas PLC. Monthly income debentures at a 6% return and preference shares in credit finance had an average dividend of 5.6%. As previously explained, the total stocks and call accounts fluctuate marginally on a daily basis, but these fluctuations are not significant. I now hand over the savings bank statement listing the investment for February 2015.
Yes, I note, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Gentleman is answering the question of the Minister for Economic Development. I'm not the Chief Minister, though I have to say that we do feel much, much safer if you're answering the question that Chief Minister will be voted, because at least you understand what we're talking about. Mr. Speaker.
because the figure for Brett and the figure for Kathy Brett is for the 1st of March 2015. Bearing in mind that we are just a month away, a month from that particular date, away from the end of the financial year, bearing in mind the government's commitment to reduce the public debt, gross debt, by half, unless the government has a significant increase in revenue in this month, in other words, from the 1st of March, these are the figures, for the 1st of March to the end of March, the gross public debt is not going to be cut by half, certainly in this financial year, and therefore we won't see that at the next budget. They will do it, the Honourable Gentleman says, well, actually we do expect it before the end of the month, because, for example, the sale from the premium at the on the East Side development is going to reach over 100 million, and perhaps increase in the sale of tobacco, we're going to power that into a reduction of public debt. But does it expect the government's target of a reduction of public debt, gross public debt, by half, to be met before the end of this financial year?
Speaker, I am at a loss to understand why he should ask me if I expect that to happen when, in fact, he's got the book that we approved in this parliament a year ago, where the expectation in that book is that the debt should now be 450 million, and it's 448. So, in fact, the expectation of the government was that there would be a debt of 450 at the end of March, and there is 448 at the end of February. So a month ahead, we are already 2 million below the figure we expected. So I don't know why he thinks I'm expecting it to be 260 million by the end of this month, and that is not what the book says. What we have said is we expect it to be 260 million in the term of office of the government, which maybe he regrets is not going to be at the end of this month. They're still going to be there on the 1st of April. So he was expecting us to disappear at the end of the month. I'll have to tell you, he's an April Fool of the 1st.
So, Mr. Speaker, the question of the reduction of the public debt by the gross public debt by half is a commitment that the Honourable Gentleman stands by the end of this year. Can I ask him whether he expects to fulfill that, bearing in mind that the only way that he can do so is through the influx of extra capital generated by the government, because it's not going to happen just simply on the basis of the income that the government generates on a recurrent basis. I mean, this is going to have to be done from some extra sale of some government assets. That's why I spoke about the East Side development. Can you provide us with some information as to how the government intends to fulfill this manifesto commitment of reducing the public debt by half by the end of this term in office?
No, Mr. Speaker. I don't think that there is any obligation to assist the education of the members opposite by telling them how things can be done. We commit ourselves to do things and we do them or we don't. Sometimes we fail in our target, sometimes we succeed in our target. I mean, I have in the past, now, as you might be honourable member, predicted levels of economic growth which were considered impossible under the previous administration, even though they actually succeeded in doing it themselves, and were considered impossible when we had the first debate when he participated and was not yet leader of the opposition in 2012. And all the participants there were saying it was impossible to do. So the answer is that the target is still there. I am confident that we can achieve it in the time scale we set ourselves. The time scale was not 3 years, but 4.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, but can I ask him this? Did you see? It may be possible for the government to reduce the public debt by half if it receives significant premium, as I say, inside development over 100 million, and it goes directly into paying, for example, the revolving loan from the bank.
and there is an increase, an influx in tobacco revenue that the government has projected, bearing in mind that it's increased twice, and that again goes into the repayment of the public debt. But if you not agree with me, but actually that is going to be, if he does it that way, a very short-term measure. Because you can reduce public debt by half by doing that, but effectively what you're doing is starving yourself of the peace flow that will be necessary in the future. So inevitably what will happen is that the government will pay off half the public debt tomorrow, let's say, for argument's sake, on a particular date. 2 months later, and I hope it isn't after the general election, but 2 months later, 3 months later, it then has to borrow another 200 million because, of course, it is not possible for cash flow reasons to actually just simply pay off the government debt without getting yourself into a problem with respect to cash flow. Although I have to say that the government is cash flow rich in the sense that it's using 400 million from credit funds.
I think further I would like to correct the inaccuracy in the element of the question by the court, so that I can just pay off the revolving debt from the bank, because the revolving debt no longer revolves, because when he was in government, he did a swap agreement, which means that I can't repay them until 2019. Maybe you didn't know that. The reality of it is that we make a statement when we go to an election of what the target is. The target is that we will come down from 520 to 260 in the gross debt. That is the commitment we gave. A commitment which isn't irrelevant anyway, because we've kept on saying since then and before then that the level of the gross debt is irrelevant. So as far as this concerned, whether it's 520 or 260 doesn't matter. What matters is the next debt. At one stage you were saying something which seemed to suggest that by some miracle comparable in physics quantum gravity, we would have met that higher than gross debt, which I pointed out recently in a press release was not a physical possibility. So the answer to his question is, he's asked me whether I think we are going to be able to do it, and my answer is yes, and what our target will be in our next term of office when we are elected, by the people who go to the UFP, even if they complain to him about me, will be produced at the time the manifesto is published. And I hope he does the same thing and publishes what he's going to do with debt and other things.
Yes. Mr. Speaker, the other gentleman, more than I told you, I want to recognize that he's not as sensitive about the issue as he appears to be. That the complaint actually was against the Honourable, the Father of the House. The complaint was against the Chief Minister, because it was a complaint against the head of the government. So perhaps you can rest assured that they are going to be voting for the Honourable Gentleman. I don't know whether they're going to be voting for the Chief Minister. But Mr. Speaker, I have suggested that the net debt could be higher than gross debt. And look, I believe it's going long enough to understand the basics of what I'm talking about, and indeed I demonstrated that I know what I'm talking about by the way that the government constantly reacts in a defensive manner to everything that all my criticism in relation to the public debt. But Mr. Speaker, where is the government? And I understand that if the people want notice, Mr. Speaker would be right, but perhaps he might want to answer this question. When is the government expecting to receive, for example, a premium for the inside development, which I believe is what the government is going to be using in relation to reduce the gross public debt? First of all, it has absolutely nothing to do with the level of debt or the level of reserve that there are in February when the government expects to receive money from the lease of the East Side. And secondly, if I knew the date, I wouldn't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Question number 262, the Honourable D.A. Peter.
And Mr. Speaker, can the government explain why, according to table ICO.6, payroll tax collected for the month of December 2014 is approximately 5 times the average collected for each month over the previous 2 years? I think it's about 50-something million pounds for that particular month compared to roughly an average of about 9 million for the previous months for the previous 2 years.
Also, the Honourable the Minister for Economic Development and Telecommunications.
Mr. Speaker, I regret to say that a computer glitch gave us £60 million more than we actually received in December 14.
Question number 253, the Honourable D.J. Rossini.
There is a question number 74-2014 on recent public statements. Can the Deputy Minister please confirm to this House how many expressions of interest remain in relation to the EFAD project?
Answer the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government is now in discussion with two entities in relation to the EFAD project.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Deputy Minister for the answer. After I filed this question, there have been thorough announcements by the Chief Minister in relation to this. Can you give me an indication as to when he expects, or the government expects, to be in a position to make a public announcement in relation to the projects which are going to go ahead in this particular plot of land?
Mr. Speaker, I think the answer to that question is that as soon as we are able, I mean, the government is pursuing, as I said on BBC, detailed discussions now with two of the bidders. We want to make sure that we clarify certain of the nuances in the applications and make sure that the details are absolutely right before we make the award. And we want to do that as soon as possible. And we expect to be in a position to do that. Shortly, but in negotiations, it's never possible to say how the way they're going, that you're there until you stand on the dotted line. But I'm sure that we'll be very pleased when we make the announcement because we are, of course, trying to look for a project that deals with everything that Gibraltar needs, that preserves the area for Gibraltarians, that actually gets off the ground, that we see economic activity in, exactly what we haven't seen in the last 2 years.
Thanks for that. There's a quote in the Gibraltar Chronicle article. I also watched the Chief Minister's interview where he says, there is a quote from the Gibraltar Chronicle where he says, we want to see the development bring something special to the whole of Gibraltar. Is that perhaps not an answer he can provide because it will have an impact on the negotiations, but can he give us an indication of what he would like to see there?
I think the official notice of the expression is really to set out exactly what it was that the government wanted to see there. But these are not issues that will affect the negotiations because they are red lines for the government. There has to be an area, access to the waterfront, where Gibraltarians can have access. We are not going to create gate communities where Gibraltarians can have access to the waterfront and can enjoy that area as a leisure area. I'm sure that across the floor of the House would all agree that that is essential. And I don't want to take any negotiations. Neither have any of the parties who've made proposals to us, knowing that that is a red line for us, having seen that in the expressions of interest, just of anything to the contrary. The projects that we are discussing are very, very exciting projects for Gibraltar. As you can imagine, they would be a transformation of an area which they used to call when it was a GSLP. The reclamation, wrapped in Foster area, but no sooner had they taken over and it was their reclamation, it was Sovereign Bay. We'd rather not give it a name, we'd rather just see it in economic development. Will it entail any of the problems? Will it entail an extension of the reclamation, or is it what there is now? I think what we've seen from the expressions of interest of the speaker suggested that there would be a marina. So obviously, we're not going to dig into the Reformation to build a marina. The marina can come out of the existing area of Reformation. There is no intention to reclaim further in that area.
Answer to written questions, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the honour to lay on the table, the answers to written questions numbered W24 to W36 of 2015 inclusive.
Order of the day. Bills, first and second reading.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House be now adjourn to Monday, the 30th of March at 3:30 p.m. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House be now adjourn to Monday.
We are not going to do the bill.
No.
No.
So Monday, the 30th of March at 3:30 p.m.
At
3:30.
I now propose a question, which is that this House will now adjourn to Monday, the 30th of March at 3:30 p.m. I now put the question, which is that this House will now adjourn to Monday, the 30th of March at 3:30 p.m. Those in favour? This House will now adjourn to Monday, the 30th of March at 3:30 p.m.